Thank you again to the ensemble, and if any parents have children ages 4 to 7, and you wish to dismiss them to Stepping Stones, you can. Today is our last installment of our sermon series looking at the life of Jacob. And you know, if you were to talk to one of your friends or family or neighbors, whoever else, that doesn't go to church, and you say, I had heard this fantastic sermon on Jacob. Well, who's that? Oh, some guy who lived 3,000 years ago. Well, their first thought is, well, what does that have to do with today? Because you think about it, you talk about anybody in the Bible, they're 2,000 years old. In the Old Testament, like Jacob, more than 3,000 years old. Does that have anything to do with us today? And the answer is yes. Because you read history, and one of the things you see is that people do not change. We're the same. You look at the life of Jacob, he's like us. He had dreams and desires, and he had faults. And as you read in Genesis about how God deals with Jacob and how God loves him, you see that often God loves Jacob in spite of Jacob's faults. And we're the same. Well, when we left Jacob last week, it's a little bit of a cliffhanger. He had wrestled with God all night, and he comes away from that wrestling with a new name and a limp. And just in case it disturbed you too much, I did give you the good news that yes, Jacob did meet Esau and everything went fine. Okay, because God had melted all of Esau's anger and it was gone. Well, between that wrestling and meeting of God and meeting of Esau and what we're going to read about today, many years go by and many things happen. Jacob, where he met God and then where he met Esau, he's actually traveling from Haran in the northeast down to Hebron in southern Canaan because he was going back home and he wanted to see his father, Isaac, and he did. Now, there's a very obvious silence in that account where he meets Jacob, his father. Nothing is said about Rebekah, Jacob's mother. And Bible scholars believe because of that silence and because Jacob was Rebekah's favorite, that she had most likely died while he was those 20 years in Haran. Well, on the way, even from when he meets Esau to Hebron, Jacob's favorite wife, his second wife, Rachel, dies in childbirth near a little town called Bethlehem. And she has a son, and he's named Benjamin. Well, some amount time goes by, and Isaac dies, and Esau and Jacob bury him. Jacob, we're told, gives his son Joseph a coat of many colors. Very unusual in that day. There were certain colors, but there were very clear patterns that were used, from what we can tell from archaeology, to mark your family and things. But Joseph's was different. It was bright. And it made very clear Jacob's favoritism of Joseph, which means his favoritism wasn't dead. Not yet. Well, at age 17, Joseph has two dreams. And he shares them with his family, and he expects them to be all excited. I had this dream, and I'm going to be this really big-shot guy, and everybody's going to bow down to me, including you. Well, that turned out to be a very disturbing dream for the whole family. Okay, Jacob and his brothers, but especially for his 10 older brothers, because for them, that was like, that's the last straw. Okay, we have had up to here with Jacob's favoritism, and with this pampered guy wearing this special little coat who's having these dreams of grandeur. And so they decide, all right, when we can make it happen, we're going to kill him. And the opportunity comes fairly quickly. But at the very last minute, they say, you know what? Something better than death, a living death. We're going to sell him to those slave traders over there. And so every day, as he's scrubbing the floor and cleaning the toilets, he can remember, I once was my dad's favorite son. I used to have this special coat, and I had this dream. And they think, that is poetic justice. And so that's exactly what they do. They sell him as slave traders, and they take his coat. They've taken it from him. They rip it up, and they mess it up in a bunch of blood and dirt. and they put on an appropriate, very sad face. Dad, look at what we found. This looks like Joseph's. And of course, he sees it, recognizes it. He is devastated. He is totally inconsolable. Well, meanwhile, for Joseph, the next 13 years in Egypt are a roller coaster, because he is, in fact, a slave in Potiphar's house. Potiphar is one of the Pharaoh's staff. But as he works, scrubbing floors and cleaning toilets and everything he does, God blesses him. God gives him wisdom and skill, and everything he touches prospers. So over time, Potiphar recognizes it, and Joseph rises from just being the newest slave to being the number one slave in the house. She catches the eye of Potiphar's wife. She wants to seduce him, and he refuses. And so in her anger, she lies about him, and he's thrown in prison. So he's low, taken up high, dumped again. And then the same pattern happens. He's serving and working, and God gives him skill and favor, and he ends up becoming the jailer's number one helper. So that when Pharaoh gets angry with his butler and his baker, and he throws them in prison, Joseph is the one who cares for them. And they have dreams, and they're very disturbed by the dreams. And they tell Joseph the dreams, and God gives him the interpretation. And what he says is exactly what happens. The baker loses his head. The butler is restored. And the butler is so glad. Joseph, I am so glad. You know, man, this is fantastic. I will never forget you. Off he runs, and he forgets him for 2 years. Until Pharaoh has dreams. And he knows they mean something, but he doesn't know what. And nobody can interpret the dreams. And I am pretty sure that when the butler hears of the situation, he goes, oh, man. And he runs to Pharaoh and says, Pharaoh, I know you got these dreams. Don't worry. I know a guy. Gets Joseph out of prison, gets him all cleaned up, takes him to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says, hey, I hear you can interpret dreams. And Joseph says, no, sorry, bud. Sir, not me. God can. Tell me the dream. And he tells him, because he had two dreams. And Joseph says, God is giving you a message, and it is very clear. He confirmed it by telling you the same thing twice. Egypt is going to have 7 years of great crops, bumper crop every year, food just kind of coming out your ears all over the place, followed by 7 years of famine. Famine is going to be caused by drought. No rain, no food. No food, you get a famine. And it's going to be so bad that everybody's going to forget the 7 years of good. So Pharaoh, suggestion. Have your officials collect up all that extra in those 7 years so that when the 7 years of famine come, can be given and the people won't starve. Now here's something that Joseph doesn't do. Hey, Pharaoh, you should find a guy who can help you. No, he doesn't point to himself at all. But Pharaoh's a smart guy. He says, look, I need somebody in charge of all this. You said that only God can interpret dreams, and he showed you what the dream means. That means the Spirit of God is in you. Who better than you to take care of all this? So, right there, he becomes number two man in all of Egypt. His dream came true. Well, the 7 years of plenty go by, and during those 7 years, Joseph marries, and he has two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And then the 7 years of famine begin. And the famine wasn't only in Egypt itself, it was in Canaan as well, which is where Jacob and the rest of the family are living. And so Jacob sends his 10 oldest sons to Egypt to buy grain. And they get there, and it's been 13, probably maybe 15 years that Joseph's been gone. He went from 17, he's in his 30s now. Probably his head was shaved, he's dressed like an Egyptian, and speaks like an Egyptian. They don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And some people read that account and think, all right, Joseph's supposed to be this great guy, but look at how he plays with them. He's getting at least a little bit of revenge here. I don't think so. It might look like he's toying with them, but what he's doing is setting them up. Because if you know, they come twice to get grain. And the first time, he's asking questions. So, tell me about your family. How about your dad? And what about the rest of the family? And he finds out they have a younger brother. And he tells them, okay, so if you have to come back for more food, you don't even bother coming if you don't bring your younger brother. They don't know anything. When they come back the second time, and it took a lot of convincing of Jacob to let Benjamin come, but he comes. And then, again, Joseph arranges things so it looks like Benjamin is guilty of stealing. And Joseph threatens to put him in prison. Why? He went through all of that to set up this one situation because he wanted to see what the brothers would do. They said, oh my goodness, Benjamin, how could you do that? Sorry, sir, let him rot in prison. They would have known, Joseph would have known, that his brothers had not changed. But they don't do that. They don't know that he knows their language because he's speaking Egyptian using an interpreter. And so they're talking to each other when they see this threat of Benjamin. And they're saying to each other, oh, our sins have come upon our heads. Remember what we did to Joseph? And now all this mess is happening. And Judah steps forward and says, sir, would you please take me in place of my brother Benjamin? At that point, Joseph is sure. God's changed their hearts. And he says, in their own language, hey guys, it's me. Now, if they weren't scared before, they are terrified now. But he says, as you read the account, he says, I know you meant it for evil. You hated me. But God had a plan, and he's working it out, so not a problem. And he brings his father and his brother's families, the whole group, with everything they own, to Egypt, and they settle in the land of Goshen. And some time goes by, and we're told that Jacob lived to be 147. Now, that's a ripe old age. That is a lot of years of Social Security. Okay, a lot. Well, when he knew he was getting close to death, he did three things. He calls Joseph and says, Joseph, you have to swear that when I die, you're going to bury me in Canaan in the tomb of my father and grandfather. And Joseph does that. Jacob gives a blessing to Joseph's two sons, and then he gathers all his sons together, and he gives his final words to them. Now, if you read in the New Testament in Hebrews, Hebrews 11 is called the Hall of Faith. The whole chapter is about faith, and it talks about these great heroes of the faith, like Abraham, who leaves home and everything else, like Moses. And then you get some very unlikely people in there, like Samson. Okay, would not ever expect him, if you read his account, that he's going to be there. And Jacob. Jacob is there. And this is what we read in Hebrews 11:21. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. And our verses today, which we're going to read in just a second, show us what was happening when Jacob gave that blessing. Now remember that ever since Jacob wrestled with God, he has two names. And in what we're going to read in Genesis, we get that second name, Israel. So remain seated, but let's read together Genesis 48, verses 8 to 16. Let's read. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, who are these? Joseph said to his father, they are my sons, whom God has given me here. And he said, bring them to me, please, that I may bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, to see your face. Behold, God has let me see your offspring also. Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. Go to the next one. Thank you. And he blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys, and then let my name be carried on, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." We're going to come back to the first part of these verses later, the whole thing about the right hand and the crossing of the hands and all that stuff. But if you look at the last two verses, and if you leave that last slide up there, verses 15 and 16, there are three different thoughts that I'd like us to see, that I want to highlight, that come out of these verses. And you find the first one in verse 15, where Jacob, or Israel, says, "The God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day." This is the first time in the Bible that God is called a shepherd. Now, Jacob has been a shepherd a long time. He shepherded sheep for Laban for 20 years, and then ever since then. So he is very familiar with sheep. And he calls God his shepherd, which means that Jacob, in a way, is calling himself one of God's sheep. Well, Jacob knows what picture that paints, but we don't, because we're not familiar with sheep. So there's a fantastic book called A Shepherd Looks at the 23rd Psalm by Philip Keller. He's a recently modern-day shepherd who was able to look at the 23rd Psalm and then, from his own personal experience of dealing with sheep, say, "This is so rich. Let me share with you some of the richness." And so here are some things that he says about sheep that help us understand what's going on here. First, sheep are vulnerable. Have you ever heard that expression, "Help, I've fallen and I can't get up"? Okay. Well, if a sheep falls and lands on its back, and if he cannot roll himself over, so he fell in some rocks or something and he can't, it's called a cast sheep. And if he stays that way for too long and the shepherd doesn't come and get him, he's going to die. Just the way the sheep is made, the physiology of the sheep's body, he's going to die. Second, sheep need to be led for their own good. Okay? If the shepherd doesn't lead the sheep and he's not thinking ahead and planning, the sheep will destroy the land and they will make themselves sick. They'll destroy the land because if you leave them in one place too long, they just eat the grass and eat and eat and eat until they've eaten it all the way down to the roots and they kill it. So the shepherd has to move them around and use them kind of like a living lawnmower. Eat the top part, move them up to the next place, eat some more, move them, keep moving. The other part has to do with what happens when sheep eat grass. Sheep are like cows. When a cow eats grass, a cow makes cow patties. Okay, when a sheep eats grass, it makes sheep patties. And if the shepherd is moving the sheep along as they go, all those fresh sheep patties dry up, and they actually become fertilizer. But if there's no shepherd and they stay in one place too long, they actually get sick because the grass is now mixed with all the sheep patties. Next, and this should not be a surprise, sheep are stubborn, habitual, and will stupidly follow the same trail even though it's the wrong trail, okay, if given the opportunity. When the sheep drink, they didn't have a lot of troughs and things back then because they didn't have pumps. And so they'd take them, find them water, but it had to be quiet water. It had to be shallow, and it couldn't be fast-moving because if a sheep falls in deep water or gets into fast-moving water and swept, it's going to drown. Then as the sheep are being moved from place to place, there's those in-between times. And sometimes those in-betweens are dangerous. It can be a canyon. It can be other places where it would be easy or easier for a wild animal to attack. And sheep are defenseless. If you've ever seen any of the nature videos, there are some animals that have horns that when a wild animal comes, they gather the little ones in the middle and all the adults get facing outwards in a circle, horns out, hooves out, and they have something to fight with. Sheep don't. They're defenseless. And when the wild animal comes and things are going crazy, they do one of two things. They freeze or they go crazy and run. Either one makes them easy targets for the wild animals, which is why the shepherd has a long staff, wooden pole kind of thing that he takes with him to defend against the wild animals. But he uses it a second way, and it's among the sheep. Because you can have a sheep who starts bullying the others. Get out of the way. This is better grass. Okay? Get out of the way. I want this water. And so he'll use it on the bully as well. Now, for a sheep to be healthy, they need regular food and water, and they also need regular rest. But they do not rest easily. They have to be totally free of fear. No wild animals, no strange noises, nothing that might disturb them. They have to be free from the bullies, be free from pests, and have plenty of food and water. Are you getting the sense that it takes a lot of work to take care of sheep? In fact, it's 24/7 total care to care for the sheep. And finally, it is the nature of sheep. Even if they are being totally cared for, they have the lushest of grass, the best of water, there are no wild animals, do they ever say thank you to the shepherd? No. Thank you for that response. Okay, just so you know, preachers like responses. At least some of us do. I do. Okay? So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, Jacob has all of this in mind about sheep when he says, God is my shepherd, and I am like them. And we're just like him, and we're just like them. The parallels are many. Spiritually, we're stubborn, we're helpless, we're clueless. But yet God cares for us just as a good shepherd does. That's the first point. You see, the second one in verse 16. So one, Jacob says, God is my shepherd. And then second, in verse 16, Jacob says, God is the angel who redeemed me from all evil. Now that word redeem can have two meanings. It can mean to deliver or protect. And you look at Jacob's life. When he has to leave home because of the threat of Esau, and he's going to his uncle Laban in Haran, it looks like he's traveling hundreds of miles alone. God protects him. When he gets there, we find out later that Laban changed Jacob's wages 10 times. God protected Jacob from Laban's trickery. He still caused Jacob to become wealthy. God protected Jacob from Esau. When they meet after 20 years, all the anger was totally gone. God protected Jacob from the peoples of Canaan when he's traveling from Haran down to Hebron to meet his father. Sorry, I'm getting a little stuck here. It's just him and his family and what servants he has. And there are some large cities, large groups. God protects Jacob by putting fear in the other people. They won't touch him or do anything. And then finally at Peniel, when Jacob is wrestling with God, God protects Jacob from Jacob. Okay? He really begins in earnest this change of character from a grasping, selfish man to a man who's saying the things that we're reading today. But it can also have a second meaning. Redeem can also refer to paying off a debt. See, back then, if you got yourself in trouble, if you weren't careful with your finances and you ended up in debt, they didn't have bankruptcy laws. If you ended up in debt and the debt collectors came to collect, first they would sell all your property, and then they would, if you had a family, they'd sell you and your family into servitude to pay off the debt, unless there was a relative who would step in and redeem you by paying the debt. And I believe what Jacob is referring to here is both. Yes, God protected me, but he also, I think Jacob saw his spiritual debt, his spiritual need for God, and that God had blessed him. So you have shepherd and the angel who redeemed. But if you put the two together, what you see is the third point is this. Jacob is looking back at his life through the lens of God's grace. If God wasn't in the picture, he could have said things like, "Oh man, was I lucky. You know, look at this. My uncle was so mean, and I still managed to come away with some pretty good stuff. And can you believe it? I meet my brother, and I think he's going to kill me, and he's happy to see me. What a coincidence." He's not saying that. He's saying, it was God who protected me. It was God who provided for me. God was working. And I believe in this, Jacob saw his own lostness. Remember, he calls himself a sheep without actually using the word. He sees his own foolishness. And you know, for him or for you or I, for us to see our need for God is God's kindness. Because that's the truth. Our need is that great. And then the other thing he sees is that God is not this remote, distant God that I'm yelling, "Hey God, can you listen?" and try to get his attention. God's like a shepherd. You know, you don't have remote sheep herding. It just doesn't work. Got to have boots on the ground with the sheep so you can see them and see what's going on and what's around them. And what Jacob is saying when he says God is his shepherd is God has boots on the ground. And God is right there with Jacob. And he's caring for him. And that God was his spiritual shepherd that came after him when he wandered off like the stubborn sheep who's going down the wrong trail, even though he knows it's the wrong trail, but he still wants that other little piece of grass that's way over there. And God came after him, and God protected him. And he says all of this as he's blessing Joseph's sons. And so in a sense, what he's saying, reminding himself and reminding them, this is the character of God, the God that I'm asking to do good to these two boys. Now, you and I, regardless of your age, can look back at your life and say, I see God's goodness. I see God's hand. I see how God has provided, how God has protected, how God has cared. I also see my own foolishness and selfishness. And we can all say in one way or another, I think, some of us more than others, yeah, life has been hard. And for some of us, we can say, yeah, and I did it to myself. But God has been a good shepherd. He's been a loving shepherd. Well, we have that picture not only in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament. In John chapter 10, Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And that's what we're celebrating today, is Jesus' sacrifice, that he gave his life for us. One other thought, and it comes from the earlier verses that we looked at, all having to do with Jacob's right hand, who's on his right hand, and the crossing of the hands. If you read the whole account, you'll find out that Joseph is not happy with Jacob. We read the part where he takes his older son and puts him on Jacob's, let's say I'm Jacob, puts Manasseh on Jacob's right-hand side, and Ephraim on this side. That's because in that day, the right hand was preferred. If the homeowner or the king, whoever was having a party, the most favored guest sat right at the right hand. And here, Jacob's going to give his blessing to the two boys. And so Joseph arranges for the older to be on Jacob's right hand and the younger to be on his left. But when he goes to actually give the blessing, he does this. He crosses his hands. And Joseph actually tries to move his hands back. And Jacob says, no, no. I know I can't see, but I know what I'm doing. I know how you've arranged them. I know Manasseh's over here and Ephraim's here. And I'm going to bless them both. But Ephraim's going to get the greater blessing, even though he's the younger. He knew exactly what he was doing. And what you see in this is you see a pattern. That God picks the lesser. That God picks the weaker. In movie terms, it's like God picked Captain America when he was still this weak little dweeb. Okay? In the Old Testament, you see Jacob. God chose Jacob before Jacob was even born. He gave the prophecy, the younger son of the twins, Jacob's the one who's going to get the inheritance. Here, through Jacob, he picks Ephraim, the younger son. Look at David. David's not number two son. He's number eight. Okay, when Samuel comes and God says to Samuel, all right, I'm going to choose a new king to replace Saul. Go to Jesse of Bethlehem and sacrifice there, have a meal. When they're having the meal, Jesse doesn't even have David there. He's back with the sheep in the back lot. They have to call him and bring him in. Did God choose him? But it's not just an Old Testament thing. In the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 27, we read this, but God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. You see, the weak and the foolish are us. And anybody else trusting in Jesus, the shepherd, the good shepherd who died in our place. Think, how do you explain this to somebody, say you have a friend or an acquaintance, who knows nothing about the Bible? So you really like this guy, Jesus, but he died and was crucified. You know, that's a form of torture, right? He's tortured and he died. That looks kind of foolish. Why would you make him your hero? Why do we celebrate the man who loses and dies? Because God's values are upside down from our default values. We're told, well, if you want stuff, you have to work hard and then start collecting and you guard all your stuff. God says, it's when you give away that you receive. God says, you want to save your life? Lose it. You want to be great? Serve other people. It's totally backwards. And Jesus leads us. He shows us what this looks like. He left heaven, perfection, to come to earth as a man. And he lives and he gives and he serves and then he suffers and dies for us. Because he knew that only what he did could reconcile us to God. He was the shepherd. He is the shepherd. But that wasn't the end because he rose from the dead, which is why we began the service this morning with, he is risen. And we celebrate. We celebrate with this meal to remember what Jesus has done. And yes, it's a serious meal and a somber meal, but we're going to celebrate today. We're going to celebrate while we sing. I'm sorry, by singing a little bit. While we're serving of the bread. It's a song you might or might not be familiar with. It's called The Table. And it's talking about a table, but not this one. This table is just the pointer to the table in the song. The table in the song is the one that we're going to be sitting at when we go to heaven. Because you see, this little piece of bread, this is not a feast. It's a pointer to a feast. We're going to sing about the table, that we're going to feast at the table, and that we're going to have peace at the table because of God. The elders would come forward.